Thanks very much, and it's a wonderful pleasure to come back to Santa Barbara. See all the great things going on here, and hopefully try and convey to you something interesting about cosmology and understanding the universe. So the title of, first of all, I should explain, there's one important point, which is to keep the beach on your right-hand side when going to the picnic. Apparently people didn't follow that last time and ended up at the wrong place. The title of my talk is Before Inflation, and as I'll describe, inflation is our most successful phenomenological model for how the universe started, how the fluctuations in the universe were formed. But the title of my talk is, the topic of it is a theoretical topic, which is what happened before inflation. I think just like with the weak interactions, when there was Fermi theory, which was very successful, it was through thinking through the limitations of Fermi theory and the inherent contradictions in it that further progress was made. And that's what I'm going to focus on, the limitations of inflation and how to make progress in understanding it better. So I want to begin just by reviewing what we know about the universe and the fact that it's very complicated in some respects, but extremely simple in others. And then I will go on to inflation and quantum cosmology. If the current interpretations of the observations is correct, we are really seeing the effects of quantum cosmology in the microwave sky. And so it is a very challenging theoretical problem to try and treat those properly. And I think it's a good inspiration for what follows. I'm going to focus on the initial conditions problem in inflation. In inflation, there's what I would call a certain cheat that is performed to do with the initial conditions. And I will discuss this and say how you might try to overcome it. I'll discuss a proposal for solving this problem called the no-boundary proposal and how this is implemented technically with instantons and how one computes fluctuations around instantons. This part of the talk will basically, I'll show that if you take inflation and the no-boundary proposal, then the most probable universe one obtains is actually empty. It's actually just the universe in its vacuum. It's not very interesting. But I will argue at the end that in fact what we ought to do is compute not a unconditional partition function, but a constrained partition function in a certain way. When you do this, you recover a volume factor to do with how much inflation happened, and I'll show you how you can compute this volume factor in a covariant way. This work was initially started with Stephen Hawking at Cambridge, and the work I'll talk about in this talk is mainly with these students and postdocs at DAMT. So just to review what we know, according to the Hot Big Bang, the universe started out very small and expanded and cooled and formed galaxies and stars. The foundation for our understanding of all of that is general relativity. One assumes a metric of this form, closed, flat, or open spatial slices of the universe, times a scale factor, which describes the growth of the size of the universe in time. And the growth of this scale factor is governed by Einstein's equation, which tells you that the Hubble constant, which is dA dt divided by A, is 8 pi over 3 g rho minus k over A squared. So the usual convention in cosmology is to say this is H naught, Hubble constant. The right-hand side is Hubble constant squared times the sum of dimensionless numbers, omega, which give you the fractional density in each of the constituents, and general relativity, these add up to one. So this transparency serves two purposes, I hope. One is just to tell you notation, But the other is that in cosmology, with all the extremely exciting observations there are recently, and that's certainly what's driving the subject, nevertheless in cosmology, as in perhaps no other part of physics, theory really is the bottom line. You cannot interpret the observations without theory. And when people plot observations, it is always implicitly assuming general relativity. So in my view, what? Yes, because other areas are experimental, for example, in a way that cosmology isn't, that you can test. The ratio of observations to theory is perhaps lower in cosmology than in other, even though it's very high and very exciting. So that's my excuse for this talk focusing on theory rather than observations. So theory is really very, very important in cosmology. So what we know about the universe, and I'm not going to show you the observations, I'm sure there are other people who have reviewed some of these. The last 3 years has seen something very exciting in cosmology, which is the emergence of something like a standard model, that the observations are now fitting together in a way they were not previously, and the universe we see seems to be 70% cosmological constant, 25% some sort of dark matter, 4% baryons, ordinary matter. Then we have neutrinos and photons. And that's a big mess, basically. It's a surprisingly complicated story. There isn't any theoretical reason for these numbers coinciding to within a few orders of magnitude. Each one of these coincidences is a puzzle, a profound theoretical puzzle. And so in that sense, theory is not really doing very well in explaining what the universe is made of. There are also some cracks in this model, which is the current standard model. The dark matter seems to be misbehaving on small scales. Dark matter clustering does not look like real galaxies. If you look at high-resolution numerical simulations, they show galaxy halos with lots of little sub-halos inside them. It is not what real galaxies look like. And that's leading some of us to make models with different types of dark matter which can resolve these problems. Also, gravitational lensing is now setting strong constraints on omega lambda, which may be becoming mildly inconsistent with the supernovae measurements. So this is a complicated story. However, the universe is amazingly simple in two respects. One of which is that these numbers add up to approximately one, and this is really what the boomerang experiment has confirmed, that the universe looks as if it is flat, spatially flat, though the error bars are still significant. The other is that fluctuations in the universe seem to take the simplest possible form. Okay, so what do I...
0.3 is smooth.
Boomerang.
That's what they say?
They have various, not altogether consistent errors, but I think...
Some of the boomerang people should be here, right? Oh, John.
Yeah, that's a main signal right there.
What is main signal?
In our best analysis, if you just take boomerang and throw a maximum, we're at about 1.1 plus or minus 0.1 roughly, at about 1 sigma.
1 sigma.
Yeah, so 0.3 is maybe 2 or 3.
Is that an analysis with priors or without
That's
priors?
That's an analysis with very weak priors. So.
Okay, yeah. So there are various priors, which, and depending on the priors, you get smaller. You can get smaller error bars. If you put no priors in...
Actually, when we put our flat universe prior on, then it becomes...
Which you do.
Right?
No, which you do in your paper.
Right.
Anyway, so this number could be plus infinity, I think, if there were no priors.
No.
It's a plus.
No,
it's a big number.
It does fall off.
Right. Okay.
If you want to have universes that are 60 years.
Right. There are priors you can put in. Okay.
Data. Other data.
Yeah.
We
no. That's right.
On things like the speed of light.
Right. Okay, well, that's good. All right. I'm not arguing. Well, let's not argue any more about it. I think history shows in cosmology it's good to be conservative in interpreting error bars. Okay, so theory. And again, let's just emphasize the point that theory really plays an important role in cosmology. The theory of the fluctuations in the universe has always, well, there's always been this idea, which is that the perturbations can take a, quote, simplest possible form. What does that mean? This has been around since the 70s. What does that mean? It means that the fluctuations should be equal on all scales, scale invariant, so that they do not diverge at short distances or at large distances. They should be adiabatic, which means that all particle species in the universe are perturbed in fixed ratio. Okay, so if you perturb the photons, you perturb the baryons, you perturb the dark matter, the abundance ratios of species is left unperturbed. You don't have to do that. There are other ways to perturb the universe. These are called isocurvature modes, and it's interesting to try and exclude those observationally or detect them. And finally, the assumption is that the fluctuations are Gaussian random noise, the simplest possibility. And so the idea here, if you take these, this type of perturbation, follow the perturbations forward in time, so imagine some plane wave, wave number k, following it forward in time, the amplitude grows with time, then as it basically as the speed of light times the wavelength divided by the speed of light becomes equal to the time. So just the speed of light, light has encompassed this wave, the wave starts to oscillate. And these oscillations are reflected in the sky. So when you look at this sky map, these beautiful maps made by Boomerang, you should see features, the strongest features on from the wavelengths which have hit that first maximum just at the time when the universe became transparent to radiation. So we look at the sky, we're seeing the hot photon baryon fluid at the time when the radiation comes to us, and the strongest perturbations come from modes who had just hit their peak. Now if we go to shorter wavelengths, we see modes that have hit zero or have hit their second peak. So here's the modes hitting zero, here's the second peak. And this theoretical curve follows from the assumptions that I told you about. So here's the Boomerang data, temperature fluctuation against angular scale. And the fantastic success is to see this peak sitting where it was anticipated to sit at least 25 years ago. Under the two assumptions that the universe is flat, okay, that actually puts the peak at about 220 rather than 200. But it's pretty good agreement. And these fluctuations were of the simplest character. All species perturbed equally. In fact, I mean, this, the other thing this demonstrates is that cosmologists can't add. Because if you look what the model is that fits it, of course, if you add up the different omegas, they come to greater than one. So the best fit model, the peak being at 200, is a sign that the best fit model is actually marginally closed, which I think is what...
Because the cosmologists can't read, because the 1997 Boomerang test flight data is best fit model, not the best fit for that data.
That's right. The solid curve, yeah. Well, in a paper that says the universe is flat, why do you plot a graph with a closed universe? It's a strange thing to do. Never mind. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about inflation. So having offended the experimentalists, now I'll offend the theorists. Inflation is based on a very simple idea, and this is a picture taken from Jim Peebles' book. It shows Professor De Sitter blowing up a balloon. That's the expanding universe. And it says, What, however, blows up the ball? What makes the universe expand or swell up? That is done by the lambda. Another answer cannot be given. And so, as far back as the 20s and 30s, they understood that the presence of a cosmological constant could blow the universe up. And that's the idea of inflation, except inflation adds to it the idea that you can switch off the lambda. The lambda can be dynamical. So one has a scalar field, you postulate a scalar field phi with a potential energy, and when the field is up the hill, that contributes a lambda, which drives the exponential expansion, so that's like go, and when it reaches the bottom, then the expansion switches off and is governed by the Einstein equation just for matter and radiation. So scalar fields can drive accelerated expansion, which means the acceleration of the scale factor is positive. And if we look at the equations of motion for the scalar field, it's a ball rolling in a hill with a damping term. The Einstein equation looks like this, that the acceleration of the scale factor is proportional to potential minus twice kinetic energy. And if the slope of the hill is small, and if phi dot is small, then the scale factor grows exponentially. Okay, so that's what was shown in De Sitter's picture. And the Hubble constant squared is given by this potential energy over 3 times the Planck mass squared. I should say 8 pi g is 1 over m Planck squared. This can explain the size, the flatness, and the smoothness of the universe, as I'm sure you know. But in this question, in this talk, I'm going to take a slightly more critical view than usual of inflation. The obvious question is to ask, what is phi? There's no experimental evidence for phi at the moment. But equally, there's no shortage of candidates for phi. But any theory, such as M-theory, supergravity, string theory, is replete with candidate fields, phi. And so, in fact, the problem is not so much what is phi, but which particular phi is the one that drove inflation. There's no shortage of candidates for this field. And whether you could trust these equations, that's probably true. But I think these equations do follow from general relativity and you could wonder there would be corrections to these equations as well. Why did the scalar field start up the hill? That's what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so it seems to me that in this theory of inflation, there is a basic cheat one makes, which is to assume that this field started up the hill. Of course, if you do that, you will drive exponential expansion, and the energy will be released. But in a sense, you're just assuming the answer by assuming the field starts up the hill.
That's the unusual picture, isn't this because of just thermal fluctuation and very high temperature?
No, I mean, the thermal picture never really worked because this inflaton field, it turns out, has to have a very weak self-coupling, very tiny self-coupling. And if you couple it to other radiation in a manner strong enough to localize it around phi equals zero, then it now appears you have a fine-tuning problem. Why was the inflaton field so weakly coupled? Self-coupled, if it actually couples to other stuff strongly enough to localize it. And in a way, that doesn't really solve a problem anyway, because if you go back to a prior radiation era, that has a Big Bang singularity. So it's just postponing the problem rather than solving it to say this is due to thermal effects. Biggest success of inflation, of course, is these quantum fluctuations that are seen from the sky. And this is explaining the observed pattern of fluctuations, though I have emphasized they were anticipated on sort of more general grounds before, on phenomenological grounds, I should say, before. But nevertheless, a specific mechanism for producing those fluctuations is quite amazing. And it does come from inflation, and it is a truly quantum gravitational mechanism. So what is the mechanism? The mechanism is that as this field rolls down the hill, there is a sort of jitter in its roll due to quantum fluctuations. It's not just a ball on a hill, it has quantum mechanical fluctuations, and one can estimate these fluctuations to say the only parameter that enters in those fluctuations is the Hubble constant. That tells you how fast the universe is expanding, and so since the scalar field has a mass dimension, it gives a fluctuation of order h on a scale of order 1 over h, where h is the Hubble radius, a dot over a. And this was understood in the 70s. One can think of this as the Sitter space being, if you Euclideanize it, it's a four-sphere of radius 1 over h. And so in Euclidean time, the theory is periodic, and the period is 1 over h, and that plays the same role as a temperature. So these fluctuations come from the geometry directly. Now, as you follow a particular mode, so start with a short wavelength mode in this inflating universe, as it is stretched by the expansion and crosses the Hubble radius, then goes outside the Hubble radius, this fluctuation of this magnitude becomes frozen in. And I won't go through the algebra, but basically all that happens here is you delay the conversion. So this field rolls down the hill and then is converted into radiation. And what these fluctuations do is they delay or advance the field on the potential, so when it hits the bottom, it does so earlier or later in different parts of the universe. And so the amplitude of the density fluctuations is basically to do with how early or late you hit the bottom of the hill. If you hit it earlier, then the energy you've got in that volume begins redshifting in radiation sooner. Whereas if you hit later, it redshifts less, and so there's a density perturbation. And you can estimate its dependence on the potential. And what you see from this, for example, if I just have a quadratic potential, is that the amplitude is proportional to the mass in the potential. You need the mass in this quadratic potential to be about 10 to the minus 5.5 times the Planck mass in order to fit the observation scene of the microwave sky, because the temperature fluctuation is about one part in 100,000. The other thing to say is that these perturbations are adiabatic, meaning all species perturbed equally, if there is no memory of inflation in the subsequent universe. Because the subsequent universe is described by thermal equilibrium, and so locally the configuration of the matter is just specified by the temperature. So if there's no memory of what came before during inflation, then the perturbations are adiabatic. All the species ratios are fixed by thermal equilibrium. However, if you have some field that survives from inflation into the late universe, then in general you will get these other kinds of perturbations, isocurvature. So in a sense, this prediction of adiabatic perturbations is really the statement that nothing survives from the inflationary era. It's not so much a prediction of inflation itself. So, why did inflation start? We need a theory of the beginning. Okay, so I would claim that anything else is basically putting the answer in by hand. We've stuck the field up the hill for no reason other than we wanted to make a big flat universe. So here's an example. First, one example in which you can study this sort of cheating aspect of inflation. Okay, is the following. So theory of open inflation, which actually preceded Guth's paper on inflation. And Coleman and DeLucia studied how if you have a potential like this with a false vacuum, you can tunnel through the barrier and roll down the hill. So the idea here is let's cheat again. Let's put the field up there, but we'll put it into a stable place at least. Okay, and then watch it come out and watch your universe roll and reheat. And this used to be called old inflation, but it's now called open inflation because it's realized that in this scenario you can get an open universe which looks which can be realistic, providing you adjust the potential accordingly. And this is the geometry of the situation. Okay, so if the scalar field stuck in the false vacuum, you have De Sitter space. De Sitter space is this space of maximal symmetry, which is a solution to the Einstein equations. And it's a hyperboloid. It's a four-dimensional hyperboloid embedded in five-dimensional Minkowski space. So it's just a sphere, a four-sphere, but with a minus sign stuck in front of one of the coordinates. Now, if you look at De Sitter space, so that's the space described by the field sitting there. And then in this nucleation process, the field tunnels through at some local point in space and then rolls down the hill, and this is, of course, just nucleation of a bubble. So the field goes across the barrier, the bubble starts growing at the speed of light, and when you put this in the De Sitter space, the symmetry allows you to put it, for example, at the equator, what you see is that the bubble walls are just the vertical slices in this picture. That's the light cone. So this is this picture seen from the side, from this side. And these slices, these pink slices, are what you would get with a bread slicer if you cut up De Sitter space just on flat slices in this embedding space. And these slices are actually infinite open universes. So what you see from this is that bubble nucleation can create an infinite open universe. And it's another interesting thing is that the Big Bang singularity is actually not a singularity. T equals zero is not a singularity. If you have a cosmological constant and negative curvature, then T equals zero is just a coordinate singularity, and so you can follow back through the Big Bang singularity into this embedding De Sitter space. So, and the way this is described, this Coleman and DeLucia situation is described, is with an instanton, and the instanton is, roughly speaking, a four-sphere, where it's a deformed four-sphere. And so we're going to focus on this type of object in later on in this talk. So that's one idea as to how inflation began, is that you stuck it in a false vacuum. All right, and again, I would say that, you know, at some level, that's basically cheating, putting in the answer, and but you can do it. Another sort of more, perhaps more profound argument, one that many people find appealing, is the idea of eternal inflation. So this is based on another, this idea employs these quantum fluctuations in a very clever way. So it says, well, we know this field rolls down the hill, but it's also quantum mechanically fluctuating. Could it not be that the fluctuations up the hill keep you in some sort of steady state? So as well as the classical rolling down the hill, you'd have quantum diffusion up the hill, and the net result would be a steady state, which could just continue eternally. Okay? So that's the idea of eternal inflation. Now, so you can do the algebra here if you say the fluctuation, quantum fluctuation is H, the Hubble constant. The classical fluctuation is just how much you roll in a Hubble time. And you find that the quantum fluctuations beat the classical fluctuations, providing you high enough up the hill. You don't have to be at the Planck density. In fact, you have to be at the point, just at the point, where the density perturbations in the final universe become of order 1. Because that's the same formula as the delta over rho. Basically, this is the geometric mean of the Planck scale and the scale M, is where this takes over. So that's the idea, that maybe there could actually be an eternal self-reproducing inflating universe driven by this quantum. Sorry?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So then one gets into the arguments about if you go uphill, you make more volume. Okay? So I'm not advocating this. In fact, this is I'm criticizing this heavily. So just wait. Okay, the problem is that, so people try and describe the situation. Problem is that in generic potential there isn't any steady state anyway. Generally what happens is this field zooms off up to infinity, at least with the equations they use. However, the equations they use are not coordinate invariant, not unitary. Basically, they use equations which imply this field is observed every Hubble time. And so it fluctuates up the hill and you observe it, start again, goes up the hill, you observe it, start again. So they just use random walk diffusion equations to describe this. And the description is not causal, doesn't involve causality. And amazingly, having made a model of this, which breaks every known principle of physics, it runs into a predictability crisis. So you don't gain anything, okay? So let me explain that. I mean, they're certainly very instructive models, but they lead to this very interesting predictability crisis. So this paper by Vilenkin et al., for example, assumes that the field you have a potential like this, assume that you start at the top, okay, for no reason, but just assume that you do. Then some parts of the universe will roll one down one way, some the other. So this is a space-time picture, here's space and time. And what you see here is the formation of these bubbles. It's essentially the same as that nucleation of bubbles. If you roll down the one hill, you make this patch of an open universe, an infinite open universe. If you go the other way, you make this infinite open universe. Now, there's a big problem, because where are we in this picture? And the difficulty is that these patches are all infinite, okay? That the regions of constant density, okay, or the surfaces of constant density are actually infinite. You can't say we're more likely to be here than there, because the volumes of each are infinite. You don't know how to take the ratio, and this leads to this predictability crisis.
Why do you need to answer that question? Can you just be somewhere?
It depends if you want to assume the answer or not. You see, I'm saying we want a theory of initial conditions. We want to explain why the universe is the way it is. We don't want just to say, oh, we happen to be there. Okay, at least we should pursue that road. Maybe it won't lead anywhere, but let's try and pursue that. Can we make a theory of it? And the problem with this, so another way of this crisis is that one cannot decide where we are, which is more probable. And the point of view I want to take in this talk is that this issue is resolved by thinking carefully about causality. Okay? That we sit here in this universe and that we care about the initial data in our past light cone. That's all we care about. If we end up doing a calculation where our measure involves things which are infinitely far in our future, then I claim we're doing something wrong.
That past light cone is going to go on forever,
No, good question. In the instantons I'll talk about, the past light cone is compact. So, but in de Sitter space, you're right, the past light cone goes on forever. But de Sitter space is not realistic anyway. Okay, so this is what we want. We want a prescription for computing cosmological correlators. That's obviously what we want in cosmology. We want to compute delta T over T correlators on the sky. We want galaxy correlators. We want to include in our correlators the Hubble constant and the baryon density, all the other observables. Okay, so we want some prescription for computing these correlators from theory, and then presumably this will be quantum, so we need to take the classical part. And I'll show you can do this. Okay, you can actually do these calculations at some level. All right. Whatever this prescription is, I'm going to demand it be causal. Okay, so these correlators will be purely determined by data in the past light cone, should be coordinate invariant, because that's general relativity, and it should be quantum mechanical. And I think any procedure violating these is inconsistent with the basic principles we take from the physics we know. And just to spell out, often it's not emphasized that ordinary quantum field theory is perfectly causal. People get confused about this. But if you compute, for example, the two-point function of a scalar field in some space-like region, take the union of backward light cones of that region compute the two-point function there, sorry, if you know the two-point function in this region, you can completely predict what it is there. And that follows from the Heisenberg field equations, they're causal. So don't get confused about Feynman functions or normal ordering or things like that. Quantum field theory should be perfectly causal. Now, let's try and do this in quantum. So we're going to try and do some of these calculations, and I'll show you some of the results. The idea of path integral formulation of quantum mechanics is that if a particle is at position A at some initial time, B at some later time, we compute the amplitude to get to position B at a later time by summing over all paths from A to B. And in cosmology, what you might like to do to generalize this is to say, well, what are we interested in? We're interested in the observed universe, which is what exists on our past light cone. We have some theory of initial conditions, so we're going to have a theory of what's on A, and then we need to compute this transition amplitude. Now, of course, that means we need to know what the probability is for A, or what the state of the universe is initially. And this is where the no boundary proposal comes in. So this was sort of proposed by Hartle and Hawking, and I think it's still really just a formal idea. And basically, the proof of it is in implementation of it. This is not a... So one has to actually implement this proposal to find out what it means. And that's something that is still being done. So here, the idea is that you take this space-time, the Lorentzian space-time, and just round it off on a Euclidean space by doing the following, that you make time go imaginary. Okay, so you run back in real time towards t equals zero, towards the early stages of the universe, and then time goes imaginary. When time goes imaginary, the space becomes Euclidean, it has Euclidean signature, plus, 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 and now you can round off the universe. So it's a very pretty idea that you...
It's not given.
What?
It's not given that any time...
No, it's not at all given. How do you choose the surface, et cetera, et cetera? Yes, right. No, it's not at all given. That's why I said the proof of whether you can do this is in the practice. And I'll show you how we can do it to some extent. Okay. No? Well, no, by showing you can do it.
David, can you speak up a little louder?
Yeah.
I think it's only fair.
Sure. But you haven't seen what I've done yet, so.
It's not one that has any rigorous effects. Doing it is assuming that you can do it.
No, doing it is doing it.
Exactly.
Let me do it.
You're doing it. I agree that you can go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
But your ability to do it is based on assuming that you can, that this formula will make sense at all.
I think you have to, only by doing it do you discover whether the formula doesn't make sense.
Oh, yeah.
And we will see various ways in which it doesn't make sense.
But
okay,
it's
so
a little different than starting from the Euclidean theory where you had a path integral that was...
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I'm going to list the problems in a minute. Here there is a sort of Lorentzian path integral, which I think at least everyone agrees on. It may not be right, but everybody does agree on this version. This procedure introduces new problems, okay, which I'll list. Nevertheless, the reason why this is attractive, so when you first see this, and when I first saw it, I thought, why should time go imaginary? Sounds like a totally ad hoc, artificial thing to do. Okay, but I think the more you think about this, the more you appreciate that actually it is the most conservative thing you could possibly do. Because this is how we formulate field theory. Essentially, all non-perturbative results in field theory come from a Euclidean lattice formulation. Computing Green's functions in Euclidean space, finding how to analytically continue them. Lattice QCD, obviously, is an example. You compute in Euclidean space. String theory is at least formally defined as a sum over Euclidean surfaces of different topology. Formally it is.
That's perturbation theory.
Perturbation theory. Okay. Well, I don't know what... Okay. So it seems to me this is at least, this is in fact the most conservative thing to do. It's not a terribly radical thing at all. So let's try and do it. But before we do it, let me just mention a lot of the problems. Gravity is not renormalizable, so we know that we're going to encounter divergences. But this may be, we hope, resolved on short distances by including new degrees of freedom, like as happens in supergravity or in strings. The Euclidean action turns out not even to be positive. Euclidean action is unbounded below. But as I'll explain, for certain choices of physical degrees of freedom to second order, quadratic order, this problem is solved. Okay. Now, some of the statements I'm making, I obviously don't have time to explain, but I'm very happy to give a sort of more technical presentation later during my stay. The sum over topologies seems very natural. You should sum over all topologies. Seems very unlikely this will converge. However, there are some virtues. It's coordinate invariant, at least in spirit, and it's quantum mechanical. And the main hope for this approach, I think, is that our observed universe is incredibly simple. Okay, it is smooth with small fluctuations, and that suggests it should be well described by a classical solution with small quantum fluctuations. So the way to implement this proposal, the way I'm going to discuss, is by finding classical solutions to the Einstein equations of this form and then studying the small fluctuations around those solutions. Okay, and I will only ever do anything to quadratic order, but we will see we can get quite far. So what are the solutions we're going to consider? Well, we want to look for classical solutions of the Euclidean Einstein equations possessing a continuation to a real Lorentzian spacetime. And the equations of motion aren't anything new. I've written them down before. The equations of motion are precisely these equations, scalar field with its potential, except you put some minus signs in because t goes to I tor. And when you do that, the scalar field, instead of running downhill, runs uphill, okay? And instead of driving exponential expansion, instead of A dot over A being proportional to A, it's proportional to minus A, and so the space closes off. So this is the solutions you find with the greatest possible symmetry. The greatest possible symmetry is O4. Okay, you could have had a four-sphere, which would have O5 symmetry. You can't have that because the field moves. So you get O4 symmetry, which continues in the real universe, the Lorentzian universe, to O3, 1, and that's the symmetry of homogeneity and isotropy. So maximal symmetry of these instantons is exactly what we need to explain the homogeneity and isotropy of the universe. The solutions look like the following, that as I start the scalar field at some value phi, it just runs up the hill, and the geometry follows roughly a four-sphere, but then as I go to the other pole of this four-sphere, the scalar field zooms off to infinity, scale factor goes to zero, and there is a singularity. Okay, there's a spike. What's unique about this? This is the most general solution, which is regular at one pole and has O4 symmetry. There's a one-parameter family of them.
When you talked about everybody else,
yeah.
Everything else you said you're putting in the answer. So here you're putting in the answer by matching the symmetry.
No, what we're going to do is then compute the fluctuations around this and see,
as was done in the previous thing, but in all cases you argue that you were cheating in the sense by putting in the answer, whereas here too you're putting in the answer.
Well, the hope is...
A low interpreting action that I can only...
Sorry?
When does the answer not a low interpreting action that I can only for the model for the video?
Yeah. Good, that might be an answer. He hasn't said that. You're saying that. that there's a principle of lowest Euclidean action that kicks out this universe.
Yes, we're trying to do the Euclidean path interval. So first we find...
It's something which you just argued is unbounded from below.
Now, no, we'll get to the unboundedness from below. Okay, so what I'm going to show...
Something, well, put it the other way, independent of the unboundedness from below.
Sorry?
In normal situations,
yes.
If I were to start out with
yes.
another solution,
yes.
Something would go wrong. Can you start out with something which has less symmetry or different initial conditions? Something will go wrong?
Yeah, you get infinite action.
If that's irrelevant.
Sorry?
You add a constant. It will not affect the evolution of your universe or your ability to calculate anything.
No, wait. You have to tell me another solution. I'm going to work on the assumption. What?
There are surely other solutions.
No, there aren't. No, there aren't. I mean, if I take finite action solution, I'm going to show you.
You're not comparing anything. Total action.
Yes.
As you just said, because it's unbounded from below, and that doesn't affect your ability to calculate. It's not going to affect the physics that you'll calculate in the future.
I don't understand
you're
the question.
You're expanding about yeah. some solution.
Yes.
Even if it has...
One parameter family of solutions, yeah.
Even if it has an infinite... Other solutions that have infinite action relative to this,
yeah.
subtract out that action. Or add a constant regular. It will not affect the evolution.
Well, you may want to consider solutions with infinite action, but I'm saying that things are weighted by the Euclidean action, e to the minus s. So if s is infinite, then the weighting is...
Never actually... No. If that's the case, you're in deep trouble because your action is unbounded. So.
I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to the unboundedness. All right? So I'm going to claim that that you can resolve the problem of unboundedness through an appropriate choice of variables to... Well, I can outline it briefly. I mean, when you continue to Euclidean space, one way to do it is just to put minus signs in the action. Another way to do it is to reduce to physical degrees of freedom. And basically you get coordinates and momenta, and then you can choose, do I continue coordinates or momenta? And in fact, any linear combination you can continue. And when you pick the right linear combination, it turns out that this unboundedness goes away to quadratic order, which is all I'm claiming. Okay, but let me continue. So the thing that was surprising about the... Normally you would disregard any solution with a singularity, okay, because singularities indicate the theory's breaking down. But the surprising thing about this is this has finite action, okay, that... And it all comes from the negativity of the Einstein term, that the minus r actually balances the plus grad phi squared to give you a finite answer. So you have this one parameter family of finite action, singular instantons. And this parameter phi naught, which is the strength of the... So this phi naught here is where the field starts, corresponds to the strength of the spike. And in fact, this phi naught determines the value of omega in our universe. That when you continue these solutions, you find they look like this. You take one of these solutions, you cut it on a hyperplane, continue it into space-time, and now it looks like that picture I showed you of open inflation. This is the open universe region. The singularity is a time-like singularity running up in the inflating region, and that's what you get. Yeah. You can't do it that way because then you wouldn't get a real solution in... So what he's saying is that if I cut it vertically and continue it this way, then you won't get a real solution in the Lorentzian region. The fields and the metric will be complex.
No, you can get a real solution in the Lorentzian region by making the Euclidean region complex.
Right, I'm not going to make anything complex. Okay.
But if you cut it this way, is some special point in space where the spike is somewhere in the universe?
Yeah, it's before the Big Bang singularity. So this is t equals zero, remember, and then this spike is out here. But we can see it, okay? So causally we can see it, you have to worry about boundary conditions at that spike. So when we did this, okay, if you say I'm going to integrate over all these solutions, unfortunately what you find is that the most probable value to start out at is not very high at all. It's down here, okay, one Planck mass. You don't get much inflation. And so that's saying that either this proposal is wrong or our interpretation of it is wrong. Yeah, exactly. So you get very little inflation. Now I'm going to tell you that this can be rectified later on in the talk. But it's still quite a pretty setup because you can you have a one-parameter family of these solutions, each one of which has its own spectrum of fluctuations. Okay, so you can go and compute what are the fluctuations in this region. You compute the two-point correlator of those fluctuations in Euclidean coordinates, analytically continue it into the open universe, and that predicts everything. Okay, so it's a pretty setup. And furthermore, you have a dial here on omega. You can just dial the value of the density parameter in the universe. So we've pushed these calculations all the way through. They're not easy because you've got to analytically continue in two variables simultaneously. Nevertheless, it can be done. I won't show it to you. Oh, I should mention that the singularity, what we found, is a unique result in spite of the singularity. The singularity, you might worry that things can come out of the singularity. Okay. This singularity is of a certain special form, which means that if you consider the fluctuation action about the singularity, there are two modes, two sets of modes. One set vanishes at this point, and one set doesn't. And if you compute the action for the modes that do not vanish here, they have infinite Euclidean action, plus infinity Euclidean action, and therefore in the path integral, those are suppressed. So the action itself imposes Dirichlet boundary conditions, but I should emphasize only on the modes that are spatially varying in the universe. There are also homogeneous modes, fluctuations of phi and the Hubble constant, whatever, that are homogeneous, and those modes we have to do something else. The singularity doesn't impose boundary conditions. So anyway, for the fluctuations, you can push this all the way through, which we have, and compute the observed pattern of microwave anisotropies in any one of these universes. And so here's for Coleman and DeLucia instantons. You can compute what the CL spectrum is. And by the way, I should say that that graph I showed you for the closed universe, that was not computed from any theory. Nobody had a closed universe theory of inflation. Okay, they just took the flat results and shifted them. These are actually computed results for an open universe, and we can do the same for a closed universe. We haven't bothered yet, but one can. So now I'm going to tell you about the problem modes. Okay, so think about this instanton. It's a pretty framework. You're going to compute everything in this instanton and then analytically continue it to the real universe. That's the framework. These modes, as I said, some of them vary around the three spheres. If I slice this thing, the surfaces are three spheres. There's some modes that vary across the three spheres, the harmonics on the three sphere. There are other modes that are constant. The constant modes are the problem. The O4 invariant modes, okay, so as I explained, these other modes have a unique boundary condition. The invariant modes do not. You have to regularize the singularity to define the boundary condition there.
These are the modes in the metric?
Everything. Matter and metric. Scalar field.
But yeah. There's no matter, right? There's just scalar field.
Just scalar field. That's right. Yeah. Scalar field and a metric. So, we have to make sense of the singularity. And how do we do that? So, this is the title of a recent paper in PhysRFD where we've made these things regular. How do you make them regular? The idea is to change variables on the space of fields. Okay, we had a G metric and a scalar field phi. We can change coordinates on that space of fields to try and remove the singularity, and that's possible. Turns out when you do that, the singularity gets blown up. It's no longer a point, it's actually a three sphere of finite size in the new variables. That three sphere looks like a boundary, and we're trying to do the no boundary proposal. So we have to get rid of that boundary. And how you get rid of it is by identifying antipodal points on that boundary. You close off the manifold. And finally, you've got to do a certain regularization of the potential also to make it work. So this is how you resolve a singularity. You consider metrics of this form. The original metric you rewrite as some function of x times a Riemannian metric, where this is going to be positive definite. Okay, so no zeros. Now, if I write the original metric in this form, okay, I can remove the b out the front by changing to coordinate x. In the original coordinates, this vanished like sigma to the 1/3. It looks a peculiar power. But in these coordinates, in fact, it's linear. That the conformal factor has a linear zero in these solutions. Okay, and in fact, this behavior is completely generic, independent of non-minimal coupling to Ricci scalar or non-trivial Kähler kinetic terms. You always get this behavior for scalar fields coupled to gravity. So, and there were solutions known in supergravity with this same form, and they also found they had a well-defined fluctuation spectrum. But we want to understand this now. We're going to say this omega squared is going to be a field living on this Riemannian metric. But it has a zero. And how do we understand that? We understand it as follows. That when you have a scalar field on a manifold with non-contractible loops, there are two choices for boundary conditions, periodic or antiperiodic. Okay. If you have a scalar field with Z2 symmetry on a circle, the configuration space is either like this, which is a trivial fiber bundle, or when you come around the circle, you identify phi with minus phi. Okay, and then it's twisted. That's a Möbius strip. Now, if the potential looks like this, then you can show that when the circle is large, the ground state in this twisted sector is solitonic. Okay, actually has a kink. And what this says is that as I run around the circle, see, here's the scalar field, run around the circle, I now get to this non-trivial coordinate overlap, where I've got to switch from one coordinates to the other. And that switch involves a minus sign. So if I run along in the one coordinate system, phi goes negative, but I switch to the other coordinate system, and phi is positive again, and of course you find a kink. So this linear zero emerges as a result of this twist in the field. Now, I don't have time to go through this in detail, but basically, if you take Einstein gravity, you do this change of variables that I mentioned, you see that on superspace, the metric has a coordinate singularity at omega equals zero. But it's only a coordinate singularity. So to get rid of it, change variables to basically Cartesian coordinates on this space. It's like x and y in two dimensions. And then you get this action. Now it's finite term by term. There's no cancellation involved here. Then you realize that this field, omega minus, in order, if your solution is going to solve the field equations, this has to be interpreted as a twisted field. And the only way for that to be possible is the manifold itself was not orientable. So that as you cross a certain coordinate transition, omega changes sign and the measure changes sign. And so here is the interpretation. In the Einstein frame, they look like teardrops. But if we go to Riemann frame, okay, this conformal transformation, we blow up the singularity. We then identify antipodal points on this conformal boundary. And now we've got a closed manifold, but it's RP4. And you can show that the field equations are satisfied everywhere on this RP4. Okay. So you've got to use the right covariant derivative acting on a twisted field. Now, there also exist instantons describing the beginning of closed universes. These are ones with two singularities, the same symmetry. They have a singularity at each end. In fact, Raphael Busseau wrote a paper about these when he was perhaps feeling more positive about instantons.
I think the most illustrative example that once you allow the singularity, you can do a lot of stuff.
Right. Okay, well, we'll interpret these for you, okay, in a positive way. So if you do the same blowing up of these solutions, Basically, these are two RP4, these are called crosscaps in string theory terminology. It's RP2. Two RP4 crosscaps back to back and joined up. And this is sort of a four-dimensional version of the Klein bottle. And by the way, this construction resolves a problem, a very interesting problem raised by Vilenkin, who said if I allow these singular objects, and I don't really know what's happening at the singularity, why can't I just tack infinite number of them on together? And they each have negative action, so you get arbitrarily negative action that way. But in fact, you can't do that in this construction, because you've closed off the manifold with the identification. You cannot come and stick another one on to the end. Certainly won't solve the field equations. So. In fact, it won't even be a manifold if you do the identification as well. So there are no necklaces of instantons. That's all there is. Okay, there's this one and the one singularity case. This one gives a closed universe, the other one gives an open universe. Now, you can compute the action for these things, and the action is not stationary. Okay, so this was a puzzle for a long time. That the action depends on which of these solutions you're talking about. There's this one parameter family of solutions labeled by the starting value of the scalar field, and the action varies with it. So that sounds weird. How can you have a classical solution, right, or a family of classical solutions of differing action? Doesn't make any sense, because the should be stationary. The action should be stationary. There are some. It's a boundary. That Prasad Sommerfeld, but that is, but that's you take an infinite volume limit, and so then I first thought that was a good example, but in fact there's a superselection sector there, that the values of the field at infinity.
It's definitely stable, but it's a pre-parameter.
That's right, but you use infinite volume. There's a better example. Okay, better example is Dirac's monopole on S2. Okay, think about a monopole on a two-sphere. It's not, just think about it classically, right? We're only doing this gravity case classically, so let's do this classically. That solves the Maxwell equations. Curl B and div B are both zero, but the energy is obviously not stationary with respect to adjusting the strength of B, because it's just B squared. So it's a one parameter family of classical solutions with different energy. Now how is that true? Well, it's true because this action is only defined using two coordinate charts. You cannot define the action as a global integral. It has to involve at least two coordinate charts, north pole and a south pole. And the energy is then the sum of these two things. And what you can show as, so there must be some relation between the gauge field on the north pole and the south pole, right? And there is a gauge invariant quantity relating those two things, which is the difference in the line integrals of one minus the other, and of course if you constrain that quantity to be, let's call it phi, then it turns out that the variation of the action is exactly zero. So this is a constrained classical solution of the field equations in just the same way as the instantons are. And it turns out the analog of this of the magnetic flux in the monopole is the volume of this non-contractible three cycle on the RP4. So in the Dirac's case, as David said, this is quantized. If you add particles that couple to this magnetic field, this becomes quantized, and it would be intriguing if the other case became quantized too. But this is a U1 symmetry and that's Z2, so I don't know how to understand that. So at this stage, I don't believe that it's quantized. You really have this one parameter family of classical solutions. Now, I'm going to say something about negative modes. Well, naively, you just look at this formula, all right, and you say the lowest action one is here, and it has. It's very flat, yes. That's right. It won't be sharp, but the way to explore that is actually to discuss the homogeneous modes, which is what I'm going to do next. So we take these solutions, now look at the fluctuations, and they will tell us what's happening. Very little inflation. I'm going to get lots of inflation at the end, okay? Don't worry. But at the moment, we haven't got much. So negative modes. I'm going to have to fly through this because, as I said, it's a rather technical topic, but let me just give you the flavor. Problem is, the Euclidean Einstein action has this minus grad omega squared, if omega is a conformal factor. You can make it arbitrarily negative by making this thing wiggle arbitrarily strongly. Sounds like a disaster. You can't count. The whole thing is just ill-defined. Now, what you'd like, even for Coleman Deluca instantons, okay, these regular ones without any singularities, you'd like to count how many negative modes there are. And for something like 20 years, okay, this has been an unsolved problem. How do you count the number of negative modes in Coleman Deluca instantons? But recently, we've understood how to do it. Okay, and it's limited in well, let me just describe it briefly. So this is in a preprint on HEPTH. Basically, the idea is to reduce to physical degrees of freedom in the Lorentzian region. We have this classical solution, all right? You do most of the path integral of the fluctuations in the Lorentzian region, reduce to physical degrees of freedom. These constraint equations get enforced, the gauge modes factor out, and what you find is that the spatially varying modes, the things that appear in the microwave sky, those actually have positive Euclidean action. So there's no problem. But these O4 invariant modes, okay, the homogeneous modes, these do have negative action. So you find an action like this in the Lorentzian region with a wrong sign in the kinetic term, okay, and a right sign in the potential term. So this is sort of a positive potential, negative kinetic. How do you deal with that? Imagine doing a Fourier, this is just ill-defined, okay, this will make Euclidean action ill-defined. What we're going to do is just describe that ill-definedness in a different way, which then allows us to really understand it. So we do a functional Fourier transform here, introduce a P, and then, so you can represent this term as integrating over a P, and then integrate out the Q. We change from P to Q. You notice what happens is that the B goes there and the A goes there. Now we have the right sign kinetic term and the wrong sign potential term. Okay? So in the Lorentzian region, this is perfectly okay. But now I've got this action in terms of P. I can analytically continue this action. Why are you shaking your head? This is not, I'm not doing it for a harmonic oscillator. I'm only claiming this is valid to quadratic order. Yeah, that's all I'm claiming.
Harmonic oscillators are very easy to get. You should.
I'm only claiming it's true at quadratic order.
Derived from quantum mechanics from combining classical and
okay, I'm just claiming it's true to quadratic order, okay? That's still progress, all right? So what we can do is when we do the full gravity, which I'm not going to show you, it's a big mess, do full gravity, you obtain a Euclidean action with a positive kinetic term and a negative potential term. Still says it's ill-defined. Of course, it was ill-defined. It's still ill-defined. But the difference is that you have a finite number of normalized negative modes. So you've put all the problems into one mode. Okay, that's all this does. Okay, it's still ill-defined, but there's now a countable number of normalized negative modes, which we have counted, and we follow the spectral flow, etc., etc., and a rather pretty picture emerges. That the lowest action, Hawking mass or Coleman Deluca instantons, always have one negative mode, which is to say they can be used to describe tunneling. Okay, Coleman Deluca do, after all, describe tunneling, which is what everybody thought, but had not justified. But equally, this emphasizes this Euclidean path integral is ill-defined around these solutions. They've got negative modes. You can't use these solutions to, quote, start the universe. This is basically telling you were cheating by putting the field in the false vacuum. That's not the Euclidean ground state. The Euclidean ground state is down here. Around here, there are no negative modes. Around here, for instance, on here, there's one negative mode. You should have started it down here. Okay.
Isn't it true that if you just do the usual Hawking cheat and count negative modes, that
doesn't work.
Same number of ghosts as conformal factor with step one. I think the counting does work.
No, conformal factor counting doesn't work at all.
You have a diploma, and then you have a vote.
Yes, yes.
I thought they just canceled them. That's right. As in the Laurentian, they also have, you know, where, in fact, if I don't have a physical gauge, it would automatically cancel them.
This conformal rotation procedure does not give sensible answers here. That's all I can say. Does not give sensible answers in this problem. Oh, you're saying omega goes to?
You have negative omega.
Yes. In the original variables. That's right.
You also have a negative omega that goes to the system.
Yes.
You actually do a small fluctuation.
Yes. Yes, I mean for
one and infinity,
right,
action.
Right.
Work.
It works for a pure cosmological constant.
I mean, for
yeah.
In case I know that was the short the black hole.
Yes. Right.
It's also a similar problem. There are two. You match negative mode, you find a single negative mode.
Yes. Yes. I think there's, I mean, to. No, but that's for a pure cosmological constant or for black hole. This is for a scalar field. It's a much more complicated situation. Not, those are for a four-sphere solution. This is not a four-sphere. It's deformed. Okay, much more complicated, and the matter plays an important role.
That raises an interesting question. I mean, in your case, there was a transverse traceless mode on the Euclidean four-sphere solution, which is negative.
Yeah.
I mean, now, is that also true here? Is it a transverse traceless?
No, it's a combination of. It's a combination of. Yeah, it's the scalar mode. It's a scalar mode. It's not a tensor mode.
It's not a tensor.
No.
How about 5 points?
5 more minutes, yeah, sorry. Blame David. Okay. All right. Okay, so let me describe what happens with the singular instantons, okay? Because now you've got this constraint on this non-contractible sphere. You can study the homogeneous fluctuations and you find the following rather pretty picture. Is that there are two families of classical solutions to the constraint. One at sort of large values of the scalar field, and one at small values. And remember I showed you a picture of the Euclidean action having a minimum at some value of the field. So there are actually these two families which merge at the minimum. Then it turns out that this solution is stable, no negative modes. And that solution has one negative mode. And when they merge, the negative modes become, basically you get a zero mode. Positive mode and negative mode merge, you get a zero mode. So this solution has a zero mode. So basically, there is the stable valley in configuration space. But as you go up to large values of the field, actually there aren't any negative modes. Of course, that's only true in the presence of this constraint. And so this tells you that the perturbative Euclidean path integral, right, is actually well defined around these instantons. The constraint eliminates the negative modes. So that's encouraging. The constraint is the constraint on the volume of this blown-up singularity. It's in this, the constraint is on the volume of this three-cycle. Okay, now I'm going to end by talking about a resolution of this problem that we don't get any inflation. And so this is A physics, okay, which many people are now talking about. The A can be anthropic or absence of or other denigratory terms. But I've got a way of thinking about it, which I want to try out on you, which anthropic physics. Why are you shaking your head?
We just have a name for it.
Oh. No, that's my name for it. Okay. okay, so I said before we're going to try and go from quantum gravity to correlators, take the classical part, and that will contain all the information about the theory.
Well,
but...
classical part, what do you mean by take the classical part? There's also a classical non-classical.
For example, in the density perturbation calculations, you compute the two-point function of delta t over t with delta t over t. What you find is that there is a large piece, which is which is independent of h bar, as in the limit as h bar goes to zero. And then there's a little quantum piece, which is actually complex, not even real. So you can't quantum correlators are in general complex, and there's no simple interpretation of them in classical terms. But if they are well approximated, if the large piece of it is real and can be associated with a positive definite probability distribution, that's the classical part. Okay, and you say, well, that's the part we can comprehend, and that's what how we describe the universe. So this point of view is described by David Merman, called the Ithaca interpretation. Basically, it's saying that quantum correlator, the quantum world is not something we can easily comprehend, but we can understand the classical part of it. We can understand pieces of these correlators. So that's what I mean. But I don't really want to get into that, okay? But let's just say we want to compute correlators, okay? You'll probably agree with that, I hope. I don't need to take that. You'll have trouble telling what an observer what they should measure, but I can leave out this stage if you don't like it. Okay, so what we really want isn't that at all, okay? What we want is the correlator of some observer, right, with what has been observed, okay? So I would say that's what we are aware of, and this is my way of formulating the anthropic principle, which is whoever made the observation, all right, I want to calculate the correlator of that particular individual with what they observed. If we can do it, okay, I'm saying me, but that's not right because I'm not an observer. All right, so really it should be me correlating with somebody else who actually is doing the observations. But let's pretend I'm an observer. I want to compute this. And I think if we could succeed in formulating anthropic principle this way, then actually it wouldn't be such a terrible thing. It would just be another physics calculation. Right? I want to compute the correlator between some rare object and everything else. And it's obviously true that if the thing you project onto is very rare, right, which we all are, there's no doubt that we are exponentially improbable things individually, and that exponent dwarfs anything in inflation, right? It's e to the 10 to the 30 or something. So this can have a huge effect. So let me show you how one can actually implement this. You see, I don't know what this O hat is at all, but I may only, certain things about it are independent of the details. And one of them is the volume factor. All right. He couldn't take this. Okay. Really struggling. Okay. Well, let me. Yeah. Absolutely. Fine. All right. What I claim is that. Okay. Let me cut. Yeah.
Keep the audience.
Fine.
Shut them up.
All right. All right. I'm just going to end. What I claim is that if you put in a projection operator like this, then even though the prior distribution for omega is at low omega, basically because of the huge volume you get in inflation, the posterior one is peaked at 1. Okay, but I claim this is a relatively well formulated way of calculating this. So let me just summarize. Yeah. I think, yeah. Let's have a separate time.
In fact, most of the non-experts.
Fine. Euclidean quantum gravity has some promise as a theory of initial conditions for the universe. It's important to connect it to mother theory, father theory, or brother-sister theory. That's a joke. to establish what the potential is or what alternatives there are. There are conceivably observational tests. These are admittedly very distant. But the bottom line in cosmology, I mean, I think, is always actually going to be theory. And so even though everyone is rightly excited about the huge observational progress, I do think it's important to worry about this sort of question. Okay, thanks.
The podcasts are running way past time. Maybe we'll take a couple questions from the non-experts in the audience.
I'll be silent again, I'm sorry. Nobody? No? Philosophical question?
Well, I'd like to know where the observation of material on dark matter is. Simple question you can probably answer. Where does one read about these problems of dark matter?
I'm writing a review article at the moment, so I can send that to you. But I think the person who's really pioneered this is this person, Ben Moore. Just look for Moore on AstroPH, and he has a whole set of papers on this problem. Going, Ben.
Ben.
Yeah.
Another question?
Yes, please.
Sorry?
What is five?
Nobody knows. Okay. It is a field which was invented to drive the exponential expansion. Okay, so inflation is an idea that you want to use lambda to blow the universe up. And how do you do that? You can't have lambda because that's constant. So you have to have a dynamical lambda. So you say instead of lambda, we have a field, phi, that has some potential energy, V, behaves just like a lambda, but phi actually rolls down the hill. So this is a phenomenological model for how to switch off lambda. And that's what inflation is built on. And unfortunately, we still are no nearer to knowing what phi is than when inflation was first thought of. Okay.
Okay, well, let's continue the discussion over the
molecule. Okay.
Well, thank you.